Thank you for joining me today for Chesapeake Conversations. I'm Joel Dunn. Today, I'm speaking with Rich Batuk, the recently retired Associate Director for Science, Analysis, and Implementation with the Environmental Protection Agency's Chesapeake Bay Program Office, and a new member of the Chesapeake Conservancy's Board of Directors. Rich, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Joel. Thanks for having me.
You and I worked together a lot while you were with the Chesapeake Bay program, and I hope that you're enjoying your retirement. I know you've been kayaking and enjoying the great Chesapeake Bay. We also recently published an op-ed together about revolutionizing the Chesapeake Bay cleanup by shifting it from effort-based to performance-based metrics. Today, I'd like to talk about that with you in detail, but first, I'd like for our audience to learn a little bit about your background. So where did you grow up, and have you always been interested in the environment?
Yeah, as a kid, actually, I was born outside of Philadelphia, moved to Woodstock, New York. So I was there in the 60s during the concert time period. So interesting place to grow up, but lots of woods up there in upper state New York. From there, my family moved out actually to Denver, Colorado. So I spent a lot of time in the Rocky Mountains, up to 12,000 feet, enjoying the outdoors, with a slip down to Alabama for 2 years. We ended up in up in New England, up in Massachusetts for my junior and high school years and college years. So as a kid, my sisters, my friends, we were outdoors all the time, whether it was at 7,000 feet out in Colorado or in swamps and down in Alabama or up in the White Mountains up in New Hampshire and Maine. But what struck me, Joel, was during a vacation in Maine in the Rangeley Lakes area. As a kid, I was reading Rachel Carson's Silent Spring and James Mitchell's Chesapeake. And I had this epiphany. In junior high school, I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to work on the Chesapeake. I was a fan as a kid of Jacques Cousteau's Underwater World, but I wanted to be Jacques Cousteau in 6 feet of water, not 300 feet down underneath the ocean. So early on, my sisters and my friends always thought I was crazy because I knew exactly where I wanted to go to work in this Queen of the Estuaries. And I did. I was fortunate to spend 3.5 decades working on the Chesapeake.
Well, we were fortunate to have you there and for your passion. And the Woodstock thing explains a lot, but so does the other details. But tell us a little bit about your time at the Environmental Protection Agency and the Chesapeake Bay Program Office. I mean, what did you oversee and how did you wind up there and how long were you there?
Yeah, so I started actually as an intern when I was at graduate school. So I was down at American University doing my research on Chesapeake Bay and looking at the effects of herbicides on underwater grasses in the bay. That's when we had had our big declines of our underwater meadows there. So I got in as an intern just during the Reagan administration when environment wasn't the biggest, most popular thing out there. And then, as I always told my colleagues, for the next almost 34 years, I worked not for EPA. That's where I got my paycheck from. I worked for a partnership, state, federal, local, academic, farming community, business community. I worked for partners. I worked for there's now 18 million people across that watershed. Every day I reminded myself, when I talked to thousands of farmers and local elected officials and township supervisors and city mayors and county executives, I worked for them or folks that were earning a business in the Shenandoah and building houses on the Eastern Shore. So I was fortunate to do that. My job was really as the science integrator, to bring science, to bring understanding to not only my office, but to my partners and to the larger watershed out there. So I had an opportunity to work with scientists, to work with managers, to work with Congress folks in bringing the best understanding from a fish perspective, water quality practices out there. A lot of focus on water quality, a lot of focus on putting the right practices on the ground, but also having one of the world's best monitoring systems and essentially sets of tools we call them models, like, you know, your forecast of weather. Where we were trying to understand forecasting of improving fishery decisions, habitat, oysters, and eventually, you know, what farmers were doing hundreds of miles away and people that were living on the Chesapeake with their lawns. How were they influencing it and what could they do better to put a lighter footprint on the land?
So I was very fortunate to work with you towards the last third of your tenure at the EPA. During your time at the EPA, the tools that you had at your disposal really evolved a lot. You know, technology changed dramatically, remote sensing, geographic information systems. You know, I came out of graduate school in 2004 with some GIS experience, and came into the movement and worked in tandem with you and Nick DePasquale, the former director for the Chesapeake Bay Program, to develop the Conservation Innovation Center with a team of people, including Jeff Allenby, who was a lead developer of that program. But that GIS and that data, it really brought the movement in a new, or sort of evolved the movement's direction a little bit. Could you tell us a little bit about your experience with the evolution of those tools and your experience with them?
Yeah, I think, let me start with an analogy, Joel. So let's go back, you and I, 10, 15 years when we started working together. So we were over in Delaware in the Nanticoke watershed on the other side of the Chesapeake Bay watershed. And we were given a map and we had to get over to San Francisco, California in about 4 or 5 days. Well, when you and I unfolded that map and we're sitting in a big gas guzzling van, well, that map is an interstate highway map. So we had to navigate across the country. You know what? Okay, you might be able to find that along the way. But we had no idea the amount of time, where the restrooms were, where restaurants were, hotels, et cetera. So it took us a lot of time to get across country. We made a lot of wrong turns, but eventually we got there. Well, you go ahead to, 10, 15 years later when the Conservancy was teamed up with the partnership and really bringing us light years ahead. Switch that around. You and I are now in a nice, comfortable hybrid SUV, the same location. We punch in the information into our navigation system. And we know not only exactly where we are, but how long is it going to take to get to the next rest stop? Where can we get for food, for gas, et cetera? That understanding of that information went from this big, large scale that we were making good decisions, but we were bumping down, going down blind alleys to we knew where we should be going, how you should get there, how do we do it safely, smartly, most cost-effective way to do it. To me, that's what the Chesapeake Conservancy, teaming up with all the Chesapeake Bay Program partners did, is we brought ourselves within a decade time period, light years, in terms of the ability to work with more than 70,000 farmers out there, with 2,000 different local governments from counties and townships and boroughs out there, with information to help them make better decisions. Not us, them, people that were responsible for the stewards on the ground and managing lands out there as well. So it's been a tremendous evolution of data and information. And we did it in a form that you didn't need a PhD in information technology, that you had to have the skills really to ask the right set of questions, that the tools themselves were not dumbed down. They were simplified in a way that understood that people needed to get information about their local lands, their backyards, their farm fields, their athletic fields, to be able to make good decisions.
And I have to give you an enormous amount of credit for your leadership and insight and your hard work. So just to give our listeners a little background, the Chesapeake Conservancy approached Rich and his team with the idea of producing 1 meter resolution land cover data for the entire Chesapeake Bay watershed, which, to give you an idea, the best available data at the time was 30 meters by 30 meters. Land cover data basically tells you what's on the ground. It's a critical data layer for any model, for any evaluation tool of what's happening. And the idea that we would produce 1 meter by 1 meter data for the whole watershed and our little organization at the time could do it didn't have a lot of true believers at the time. But we were very lucky that Rich understood the potential of this data to enhance the decision-making framework for our community, put the power of data into the hands of our partners to enable EPIC collaboration, to focus the community on quantified outcomes, to drive measurable results, to justify public investments, and to create new private investment opportunities. And Rich, I've always wanted to ask you this question, but I mean, why on earth did you believe in us that we could actually pull that off? And it's a very innovative step that you took there, and I always admired you for it. But was it innovative in your head, or was it obvious, or what was your thinking at the time?
I think several thoughts. First and foremost, Joel, I think it started with the trust in you and your organization, your leadership, your vision. You had a vision for the Chesapeake, but you also had a vision, like some of us as well, of how can we learn the Chesapeake and expand that across the country and eventually around the world. To me, I shared that vision with you, that I think we are learning things in the Chesapeake that many others that were working on similar situations where they were looking at small or large watersheds, water bodies that were important ecologically, historically, culturally. Second, you had an all-star cast. Joel, you had some phenomenal people there with Jeff Allenby and the team that you put together. Smart, articulate, understood things that they were talking way over my heads, but if I saw that map and the difference between the two, I knew it. The other thing is, but having talked with, as I said, thousands of farmers and local planners and folks working on wastewater treatment facilities and stormwater efforts and managing large landscapes out there, they were saying, we make decisions on acres and small pieces, and you guys are talking about 10, 20, 30 square mile areas out there. We've got to bridge that divide. You all have got to come down and talk to us. Don't talk about the entire Susquehanna. Don't even talk about the Chickawacomico. Come down and talk about my piece of property or my backyard or my fourth parcel where I've got a corn soybean rotation underway. That's where I make my decisions. So we had to figure out, Joel, how to make that leap. And one of the key things that was preventing us from doing that was, as you said, a mapping of this 64,000 square mile, six-state Washington, D.C. basin to a level that no one across the world had ever seen. Or was allowed to. Maybe the military had it, but we never had that access to that information. So when you all started to lay that out and we just visually, the impact was, my gosh, you can see houses, you can see driveways, you can see backyards, you can see cornfields versus an adjacent stream. You can actually see the squiggle of that stream versus a straight line. You were then putting a mark out there that then we had to, for our policies, our programs, and the rest of the science actually had to catch up. Once we did that, we went out to our state and federal partners, but quickly we went out to our local partners and said, just think what this could do to not only your pollutant reduction efforts, but connecting it to all the other decisions you do, whether it's a 911 in your school districts, et cetera, having information at that same scale that you can then plan across these things, not look at them like they're separate, but they're integrated together. That's what I think allowed us to make that leap with you. And it was a leap. We grabbed a hold of you and Jeff, and we pulled our partners along, and we leaped. But you guys gave us a soft landing and an incredible step forward in terms of managing this wonderful system.
Boy, we sure are lucky you did. And, you know, we pulled together a team of people that worked for about 18 months, night and day, to put the first high-resolution data set together for the Chesapeake. And we're just pulling together the second now, which should be released in December. And that's going to allow us to do change detection at the meter scale for the entire watershed. It's going to be an incredibly powerful data set for decision making. And I do need to give Jeff Allenby an enormous amount of credit for his ability to manage that team, to take a vision and bring it to the ground and deliver a product on time, and one that was just exceptional. He's now left the Conservancy and gone to the Lincoln Institute of Land Policy to work on global conservation affairs, which I really admire and appreciate, and miss his great work. So that is great background. That brings me to our recent opinion piece. So it's one thing to have a great data set and beautiful images and some knowledge, but it's another to apply them on the ground and to change how people work and where they work and why. So in the Chesapeake, you know, we all love the Chesapeake Bay. No matter who you are, no matter where you're from in the Chesapeake, everybody loves the bay. It's beautiful. It's got this cultural connection, you know, whether you're black or white or Latino or whatever your background, there's a strong connection to the Chesapeake Bay. So we're all committed to its restoration. And the movement here, we've always wanted to do the right thing. We've always wanted to clean up the bay. But we didn't always, as you mentioned in your analogy, we didn't always have the tools and data at our fingertips. So we were sort of protecting and restoring the things we thought that mattered the most. What this data provides us with is an intensely rich knowledge base for our ecosystem restoration investments moving forward. The analogy I like to use is, you know, the investment world uses these enormous frameworks for decision making. Morningstar, for example, if you're an investor, you consult their reports, their studies. They know where you should invest your money if you want to make money, right? They're really good at it. And there's several firms like that out there. We wanted to set the stage for organizations like ours, agencies like the EPA, to be able to have a similar sort of framework for environmental investments. We have a limited amount of money, a limited amount of time, and we need to be investing those resources where it matters most. And so while planting trees is great, I love trees. I want more trees. I want to save the ones that are here and plant new ones. I really would like to see the trees planted in the exact right place where it's going to have the best impact. You and I connected on this idea of moving from an effort-based movement, how many trees did you plant, to a results-oriented or performance-based framework. That is, how many pounds of nutrient and sediment did you reduce for planting that tree? And that's a very different mentality and approach, at least for the nonprofit community. I just wanted to hear your thoughts on, you know, that shift and where we're headed as a community, in your opinion, now that we have these new tools.
One of the key first things that I wanted to lay out there, Joel, and that is the land use, land cover data set that the Conservancy working with the Chesapeake Bay Program partners did created a level of trust that I had never seen in my almost 34 years of working with partners out there. And why? Individual landowners, counties, towns, other cities had a level of confidence they never had. And that is because the base layer that we were all working with almost was this blurry map that had a bunch of colors on it if you looked on a computer screen compared to, oh, I can now see the nation's capital compared to the House and Senate offices versus on the other one at 30-meter resolution. Oh, you might not be able to see that. 2 decades ago, we thought, the computers thought that the mall downtown D.C. was actually a pasture. Well, it might have been during Lincoln's presidency, but not recently. So that level of confidence was built up and was bridged, that they said, okay, you guys are finally at working on our level. Give us credit for when we upgrade a sewage treatment plant or put a underground storage capacity in our city streets, or I plant trees over here that a farmer goes for precision feeding with his dairy herd over here. If we know you're giving us credit and you're working off the same landscape we are, we're going to start talking with you. So that was the first key thing that allowed us to do. And you all allowed us to get most of those 2,600 local governments saying, okay, we're on board now. You're working at our level. And most importantly, you're giving us information and decision-making tools that we can make our own decisions. And then we can also talk about how that's helping my downstream neighbor or a neighbor perhaps two or three states down. If I'm up in New York, my back into my cows and what runs off my city streets and my neighborhood lawns influences people way down in Virginia, off the Rappahannock and off the James. So we now all of a sudden had a tool that could connect us all together, but people also had the ability to make their own sets of decisions. And getting back to what you talked about as well, and that is you have a finite amount of dollars. Our farmers, our city planners have a finite set of resources to work with, particularly our farmers. Their prices are based on world markets, so you got to be really careful with what we're asking them to invest. Why not provide a tool that allows them to make better decisions? And then eventually, as you say, to potentially raise private capital, which we'll talk about in here in a minute, that in fact, not only does their local water quality, their local streams benefit, but that farmer, he or she benefits directly. That city planner can then get credits towards their larger efforts on their permits on wastewater, on stormwater, et cetera. That people can start to actually take advantage of the co-benefits of these practices. Not just, as you say, trees are good for water pollutants, but if you put it in the right place, you can prevent floods. You can dry out the carbon from that system and actually get into a world global carbon model. That's what we need to do.
And you touched on a really key point, I think, that our listeners would appreciate. For many years in the movement here, wastewater pollution and cleaning up sewage treatment plants was a major focus and continues to be a major focus, but it reaped huge benefits in terms of water quality, investing in the improvement of the treatment of those effluents. We reached a point where we started thinking about non-point source pollution. So point source pollution is something that comes out of the end of a pipe, just for our listeners to simplify. non-point source pollution is maybe runs off the edge of a field or off of a parking lot, or it's a little harder to put your finger on. And, you know, that's the next 50 years of the – if the first 50 years of the movement was upgrading our sewage treatment plants and really identifying the end of pipe sources of pollution, which is an ongoing challenge, so don't get me wrong, it's not over, but – we did make massive improvements there, and that's really a tribute to you and your team at EPA that helped with that in the states that implemented those measures. But the next 50 years, this non-point source pollution challenge, can you explain that a little bit from your perspective just for listeners and what a challenge it is?
Certainly, yeah. So as you laid out, the Clean Water Act built really put together in the early 1970s put a focus on pipes. I live in a community. We got sewer probably in the early 80s. Previously that, we had everybody here, and we're close to the Chesapeake Bay and to tidal creeks, et cetera, had a septic system in the backyard that really wasn't treating those wastes at all. It was sort of holding them for a while and eventually releasing them. But when you flush that toilet or have that shower, all of our, you know, human wastes and other wastes, you know, through a dishwasher, et cetera, go to a central collection system in that pipe and goes to one facility, where God bless those engineers out there. It wasn't just our state partners, but counties, engineers, the professionals out there have figured out in the Chesapeake in particular how to reduce those wastes pretty darn close to drinking water levels. I'm not, you know, not quite yet, but pretty darn close to that. So they're actually, when you see that stream come out of that treatment plant, it's clear water compared to something a little green or muddy out there. That's worked. Over 470 large to medium-sized treatment facilities across the Chesapeake with billions of dollars are discharging a lot of clean water in West Virginia. I've seen that in downtown DC, Richmond, etc. That work is essentially, as you say, it's largely completed, and you need to maintain it and do that. So a tremendous number of people at the local, state, federal, private sector helped do that. That's easy. We also did a tremendous amount to clean up the air out of our tailpipes and out of where we get our electricity, either coal-fired power plants and others. So that our air is cleaner and our waters are cleaner as a result of that. Those were regulated. You could go out there, look at a facility, or even the end of a tailpipe. You could put things in place. Better gas mileage meant also better emissions, cleaner emissions. But then think of yourself, you know, drive through downtown DC and you think of all the landscapes that are out there. Go along the Shenandoah or off on the Eastern Shore or lower Lancaster County. And you see this carpet of pastures and cornfields, et cetera. The water doesn't gather at one place. You know, the runoff that comes from millions and millions of acres of turf grass that people have in their backyards and front yards doesn't go to a particular place. It usually floods where you don't want it to go. So imagine, how do you put a plan in place that covers millions of acres owned by millions of people that are trying to do the right thing for themselves and their families and their neighborhoods? That's the difficulty, Joel, that's in there. And the Clean Water Act back in the 70s didn't think of that non-point source or that sort of open landscape pollutions out there. So we've got to not go in there with a regulatory hammer and start doing it. We've got to work with people and change behavior. We've got to help them make investments that make sense to their land area, to their farm field, to their athletic field. We've got to figure out how to do that, and the tools and the information that the Conservancy has helped bring to the Chesapeake Bay Program Partnership really puts a whole new light on that, that you've got a sharper, clearer focus on, as you were saying, where you can go to and what you need to do out there.
Yeah, the next chapter of the Conservancy's work and history are emerging now. We have a new leader of the Conservation Innovation Center, Susan Minnemeyer, who worked for the World Resources Institute at the Global Forest Watch program for nearly 20 years. And she's really well-versed in tracking change and developing data and analyses for the community. In fact, she's leading now our production of the next layer of high-resolution land cover data, in addition to 3D stream maps, which are really cool. The combo of the land cover, the 3D stream maps provides us with incredible data to help identify where the best management practices can and could go to reduce nitrogen, phosphorus, and sediment from entering our waterways. And with that pinpoint level data comes the opportunity to stimulate markets and to more accurately credit projects. So in the model today, a 2-acre buffer receives the same amount of credit as a 2-acre buffer upstream. But the one upstream might actually treat 100, 200 acres of runoff, whereas the one downstream might treat less, you know. So our model's engineered today with the best available science we have. But with these emerging data frameworks, we've got an opportunity to really create more precise data, which creates an opportunity for markets, ways for companies, private capital to invest money in conservation strategies. And I have this mentor, Pat Noonan. He always told me, find a way to get other people's money and other people's time to deliver conservation results, which is a great, great idea. In this instance, the idea that private capital and private companies would take a role in the conservation movement, I think it was pretty far-fetched a few years ago. But with these large pronouncements from companies like Microsoft and Google and Amazon and pledging sustainable environmental results, devoting themselves to the climate challenge, there are huge opportunities. I know the BlackRock CEO has, for the last several years, sent a very clear message to the $6 trillion worth of companies that they invest in that he expects them to have sustainable environmental portfolios and results as a part of the bottom line of their businesses, which I find very exciting, really admirable. I would love for our Chesapeake Bay to be one of the test beds for that new, I guess, reality for these companies. How do you see that playing out in the Chesapeake and with this new data framework that we have?
Well, I think similar, Joel, to what, with again, the help of the Conservancy and your talented staff working with our partners, where we built a trust with our local governments, with our local landowners, with our farmers and others out there, with that scale of land use. And we did something also unprecedented. We sent that data back to them and said, test case it. Tell us whether it's there. You're signing off on that. That was unheard of as well. Usually they say the feds come in there, lay out saying, here it is, guys. No, we waited for them to take a look at it. That process itself was another layer on top of what your incredible staff did.
Yep, we're doing that again this time too.
But, you know, private capital and others are going to say, let's build up some trust here. You're talking about some, you know, investments, as you say, at a large scale. We want to have the confidence that if you take a different approach, that in fact that return on that investment is going to have that return. That as you say, if a farmer looks at, he or she knows that landscape, they know their pastures, they know their farm fields, they know that. But what they have never been given the information is of, well, with that swale, it's actually gathering a tremendous amount of water at this point versus over here. And if you put something in place there, you're actually going to be able to, we'll have the technology to then say, you're actually getting more of a pollutant reduction here. And that's helping you because it's no longer flooding your farmland down there. It's actually sending that water down into the groundwater. And you're going to then have something during that drought in the summer. There's going to still be water below in that water table to feed your crops. So it's a twofer right there. And then if we can also say, as you put that in place, you're increasing your forest canopy. That's reducing the temperature for your cattle or your dairy out there. And all of a sudden you have these co-benefits building on top of each other. Well, somebody coming in from a capital markets, they're going to be a little bit more, okay, I want to look at bottom line. What does that mean in terms of to that farmer? Where can I take those credits out onto a marketplace and actually get a return for my investment? So the landowner gets a return. How do I, when I'm bringing in private capital, how can I make that market? Well, it's not just a list of over the 400 or 500 best management practices that the partnership, working with land-grant universities, sea-grant universities, and others have built up over the decades, the confidence in those, but it's putting them geographically in the places that make the most sense for that practice to have the greatest benefit to the environment, to that local landowner, to that private capital investment as well. I think that's what it's building a layer of trust on a good, solid scientific foundation that people understand if we do business differently, but actually a lot smarter, and working directly with landowners, with farmers, with folks that have the responsibility for the management, really the stewardship of that land, and that the community has that confidence, the marketplace, the capital investors will have that as well. We are in the Chesapeake. We've got this Bay Pollution Diet in place. We know what we need to reduce where, essentially down to the sub-county scale. So if we overlay a map that also says where's the smartest places to do that, we've got this framework built up of accountability and science and et cetera that nowhere really else in the country and likely in the world at the scale that we've got to really not only test case this, but actually put it in place. That's why, Joel, I have the confidence that if we do all these things together, that we will be able to bring a lot more private capital, and our landowners will then take advantage of that and with tools that we're developing with the help of your organization there to put that all in place.
I'm struck by your language. You always use the term we. You really have adopted that partnership mentality through and through, and I think it's made an enormous difference. You use the term co-benefits, and I think that's really important. I want to just dig into that for a second so that people understand what that means. So, you know, when you do a restoration project or a conservation project, there are lots of ways that our community benefits. Wildlife habitat protection, public access, nutrient sediment reduction, carbon sequestration, just to name a few. And historically, when we thought about cleaning up the water of the Chesapeake Bay, we were very focused on water quality. In 2014, there was a intentional broadening of the focus on co-benefits, which I know you were instrumental in helping to engineer. And that was embodied in the 2014 Chesapeake Bay Agreement, which has 2025 goals, which everybody in the Chesapeake is racing to try and accomplish. But what was unique about that is it really brought everybody into the movement in a meaningful way. And it showed everybody where they can make meaningful contributions to restoring and protecting the bay. And I really thought that was admirable. And you built the science into each one of those goals. And remarkably, the data that you fortunately supported the development of has been really helpful to all of those goal implementation teams. And we're so grateful for the opportunity to contribute to some of that. We talked about private capital. One example of that, there's emerging carbon markets. This is one market that people may understand a little bit easier than others. There are companies that will pay for the sequestration of carbon. And there's some varying degrees of verification required. But one thing about the Chesapeake Bay that we never thought of, but that is really important, is that all of these water quality improvement projects and practices that we've been implementing on an annual basis for the last 40 years have had very significant carbon benefits. Recently, the Conservancy's team did a study where we looked at farming practices in Virginia that benefit water quality. We've found that these practices are sequestering almost 500,000 tons of carbon dioxide per year. Now that's a really exciting co-benefit to the Chesapeake Bay restoration movement. And it creates all kinds of opportunities for emerging markets. And it allows us to value our restoration movement in a very different way. I'm really excited about the potential and the opportunity. Now, those companies, they require evidence that you're going to implement the practice in the right place. It's going to deliver the result that you are professing or expecting, and then monitoring that to prove that it worked. There's another really cool thing happening, and I think this is at least partially stimulated by the data and by your leadership. There's emerging political support for applying private capital to restoration and conservation. And I did want to tell you about it because I think it's a really exciting development that almost assuredly is happening because of the confidence people have in the data that the EPA Chesapeake Bay Program and the partnership is producing, sharing with the world for free. It is publicly accessible data and providing in a way that people can understand. It also, you know, it also shows people why we're investing so much money in the Chesapeake Bay and gives them confidence that we're putting it in the right place, which is very, very important. I mean, the public trust in us, in our federal and state agencies, is vitally important for the Bay movement. And I think it furthers that trust that we're doing the right thing. I wanted to touch on one of the tools, just so, I want to get a little technical here. What is the CAST tool? Probably most of our listeners have never heard of the Chesapeake Assessment Scenario Tool. But can you tell us just this? I know you've worked on this for years. You probably built it. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, certainly. Well, I can't take credit for that Chesapeake Assessment Scenario Tool, or CAST as we talk about it. It's really, that's the brainchild of some extremely talented people, both at the Chesapeake Bay Program Partnership Office in Annapolis, Gary Shank heading up that team, Lewis Linker and others, other university colleagues from Penn State, University of Maryland, Virginia Tech, others, as well as some incredibly smart scientists and managers and technical folks across the six states themselves. And it's really an evolution of things we started back in the late 70s in terms of trying to develop tools that allow us to say, what's happening in the landscape? And then where's that pollution coming from? And how far is it getting delivered down our streams and rivers and eventually to the Chesapeake Bay? So it's simply the way I like to think about it is you've got this complex landscape out there that we know a lot better based, Joel, on the work of the Chesapeake Conservancy and that very highly detailed landscape picture of land cover, land use, where the roads out there, where are the farm fields, and is this a, you know, what particular farm field is this, and is this a pasture or is it hayland out there? That's important. So this modeling tool essentially takes that information. Think of it as a huge complex spreadsheet, and it knows all those pieces, and it also takes these 400 different practices that our scientists and managers have agreed that put this practice in this place, whether it's in a cityscape or out on a farm or in somebody's backyard. It'll have this level of nitrogen, phosphorus, and pollutant reduction. And it marries those two together and says, okay, you city planner, or you farmer, or you conservation district manager, or you business owner, or federal facility coordinator, or golf course landscaper, ask your questions. Ask, what if I put this practice on my land or did this differently over here? What's the benefit to me locally? What kind of credit can I get at the edge of my river or the stream or where it connects? And then what credit am I providing way down to those people on the tidal waters? So it takes a huge amount of science. It doesn't dumb it down. That's the key thing, Joel. It doesn't simplify it so that when somebody works on a square acre or a square mile of their own farm field or their own cityscape or their own landscape out there, they get the exact same number that the scientists and managers using the same tool in Baltimore or Richmond or at the Annapolis office of the Chesapeake Bay Program Partnership. So everybody's got access to it. The neat thing about this tool is that the interface doesn't require you to have an advanced degree. It only requires you to ask what if questions and know what landscape or what area of the watershed that you're taking a look at. So it benefits from decades of science. To not, again, don't dumb it down, but simplify it so it gives the same technical confidence at different scales. That was only really allowed to because of the data sets that you and your colleagues working with our partners, were able to bring to the table. But what it does is, and when I retired 2.5 years ago, we had over 1,000 users that you can apply online, get access to this. You don't even have to run it on your computer system. We provide the power to run this system, and you can generate scenarios from your home, from your office, from a field, and get real-time information. Previously, when I started, it took weeks for us to run one of these scenarios. Now, somebody as simple as myself or yourself, we can get outputs within 20 seconds. If it's a big one, it may take a half minute to run out there as well. That is incredible, putting that power that was in the few now into the thousands of people that could access.
Yeah, I like to think of it as like democratizing data, democratizing mm-hmm. the power of technology so that the individual landowner has as much knowledge as the EPA, you know, the big federal agency, in the power of their hand. In fact, on the landscape, on their cell phone. I mean, we built this tool, Restoration Reports, leveraging that data and some of the CAST tool results. for central Pennsylvania, now southern Pennsylvania landowners, so that they can just punch in their address and they can get a quick evaluation of where they could have a huge impact on the performance of their land for minimal investments. And it's been very, very successful. In fact, we've reoriented some of the thinking to what we're calling stream delisting strategies. So rather than asking a farmer in central Pennsylvania to invest in the Chesapeake Bay restoration movement, we asked that farmer to invest in the restoration of their local stream, you know, so that stream can carry trout again. Or you know, there's a variety of ways that there's a benefit to the farmer. And that makes a lot more sense to people. It's an investment they're typically willing to make, and it reorients the movement and it turns it into a bottom-up conservation movement. We still need the EPA's guidance and leadership and coordination, their muscle. I think we need the TMDL framework. You know, I know there's a lot of controversy right now with lawsuits flying this way and that. Although, you know, the new Biden administration, there's probably going to be some shifts in direction and maybe a calming of those lawsuits if we're lucky. But I think the movement is shifting in a very positive way to a bottom-up Chesapeake Bay restoration movement where that data, the democratization of the data, the emerging new markets, the justification for investments, the reframing of the movement to a local impact, I think it's really hopeful. And the addressing of non-point source pollution. I mean, turning that into an opportunity rather than an impossible challenge. It's just it's a really hopeful time. And I got to be honest, Rich, I don't think we would be where we are if it weren't for you, if it weren't for your steady leadership, your keen insight, your scientific rigor, you're taking a risk with us years ago that we could deliver for you. And, you know, and subsequently setting the EPA team, which is phenomenal, on a path to success after your retirement. I just have a lot of admiration for you and a lot of gratitude for what you've done. You know, a lot of times scientists in the middle of a federal bureaucracy don't get maybe the credit they deserve. I mean, I think you're really, in some senses, an unsung hero of the conservation movement. Now, our people in our movement know that you're phenomenal and did a lot of stuff, but I think to the listener that may not live this stuff every day, they will benefit from this podcast because they'll know that Rich Batuk was absolutely essential over the past 35 years to the Chesapeake Bay restoration movement and made a huge difference in numerous ways. But I'm just glad to get this story out. I'm glad to give you credit for the role you've played and you continue to play, although it's in a different capacity. And now you get to get out and enjoy it a little bit. You know, the bay's a little cleaner. We're in a little bit better position now than we were before. I think you can take credit for that. I think we're on a good path. We still have a ton of work to do. And, you know, climate change and additional population growth pose enormous challenges for the bay. But we're smarter now, and we have really a good foundation, thanks to you and other members of the Bay community that came before you, like Nick DePasquale, who you worked really closely with at the Bay program for many years. But I'm grateful to you. And so thank you for everything you've done and that you continue to do. And I'm glad that I've had a chance to interview you today.
Thanks, Joel. It, as you said, I've been fortunate to have my total professional career focus on the Chesapeake, but I've also had the opportunity to travel around the country and around the world, both pre-retirement and post. And in my case, it was because I was working for a partnership that had passionate people. That's where I got my strength, is from the passion of farmers, from political folks, from colleagues like Ann Swanson of the Chesapeake Bay Commission and Lee Curry up at Maryland Department of Environment. The list goes on. So I was just in a position to have worked with people and politicians that were at the local, state, and federal level that were willing to listen to the science, to the understanding of having organizations like yours. So there's nothing like that, like the Chesapeake Bay Program partnership that I've seen around the country and around the world that has got this governance, the shared set of goals, working with it. That's why I was fortunate to work in that. And it was truly a we, because I couldn't have done what I've done without that shared sense of we're working together with people not pointing fingers, but saying, how do we move forward? How do we get West Virginia, that doesn't have a piece of the Chesapeake, or New York, on there valuing their benefits and having a seat at the table? Well, it's because we saw them as partners. And the same thing with all other parts of the business community, advocacy community. We had a big enough tent that allowed folks to come in here. So it allowed people like me to be able to bring the science and the information, and people were willing to listen and willing to make a difference. And you're right. The Bay is much better off than it was when I started back in 1985 due to the efforts of thousands and thousands of people, and billions of dollars in investment. We're not there yet, but we've shown we can get to that space. You're right. But we needed the kind of breakthrough, Joel, that you and your colleagues have brought to the table, and that people in the capital markets will bring in the innovation and the empowerment, as you say, the democratization of that data to the people that really matter the most. And that's the people that manage those lands, that are stewards of the lands, like our farmers, our landowners, of federal, state, private lands out there. They are the people that need to make decisions. And I think the other thing you mentioned too, that's important, is people value what happens in their backyards. And that affects their immediate family, their immediate community. You know, we all think of bigger pieces, but we always start with sort of where we live, whether in a city or in a town, out in the rural country. I think by bringing that information and data at that scale, that's the breakthrough that is. And the confidence and the trust that they can make better decisions, and it can benefit them, and it can benefit their downstream neighbors.
Yeah, and it's really exciting. We've hired an artificial intelligence scientist, a data scientist, to help us automate the production of land cover. And we haven't exactly cracked that nut just yet, but I feel like in the near future, we'll have even better data on more regular intervals, and we'll have a pulse on the Chesapeake Bay landscape as a whole that will just fuel all of the direction that you were just talking about. So I'm really hopeful and grateful for your participation today. And I enjoyed working with you. I'm still looking forward to working with you moving forward, although in a different capacity as a retired EPA scientist.
Thank you, Joel.
For more information about Chesapeake Conservancy, check out our website at www.chesapeakeconservancy.org. Chesapeake Conversations is produced by Platform Media. Our music is by Scott McDaniel from Wild Echo Media. Special thanks to our partners and donors who make our work possible. I'm Joel Dunn.